is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Kenkin for Bob Kinzel. The produce section of the grocery store is often the most eye-catching part of the store, all those bright colors and textures. Yet despite the visual appeal, many of us can fall into a vegetable rut. It can be hard to branch out and try new or different veggies because we may not know how to buy or cook them or know what to serve with them. We're in a hurry, so we stick with the carrots, potatoes, and broccoli recipes that we've come to count on. Well, today on Vermont Edition, we may be able to help you out of that rut. Eating Well magazine has just published a gorgeous new book called Vegetables, The Essential Reference. It's a colorful 500-page A to Z guide, chock full of photographs, recipes, and tips. And here to talk with us about it is Jesse Price, editor-in-chief of Eating Well magazine. Jesse Price, welcome back to Vermont Edition, and thanks for being here today.
Thanks so much, Nine. I'm so excited to be here and talk vegetables.
So why focus an entire book on vegetables? Do you get a lot of questions from your magazine readers who ask for the kind of info in this book?
Well, Eating Well, you know, one of our trademarks has always been our covers, which almost always focus on a whole fruit or vegetable. More vegetables probably than fruit, probably 4 out of our 6 issues each year have a whole vegetable on the cover. So from the very front page of our magazine, we are always talking about vegetables. And we often feature, stories on a single vegetable, like a story just on cauliflower or a story just on carrots. But we also talk about ways to prepare some of these lesser known and lesser loved vegetables in every issue of the magazine. So, you know, as we were thinking about, hey, what should our next book be? You know, we want to do a big book, but we don't want to just do a greatest hits of Eating Well book. We want to have a focus. We thought, what better subject than vegetables? They are so beautiful, so delicious, and in many ways underappreciated. 90% of Americans don't get the recommended amount of vegetables that they're supposed to be eating in a day. So we know that the vegetables need help.
Listeners, what are your favorite vegetables? And do you have any recipes or serving tips that you'd like to share? You can jump into this conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your questions or comments on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Deborah and Walcott emailed us, "The gift of a spiralizer changed how I prepare zucchini. While in past years it used to be a challenge to keep up with zucchini from our garden, my husband and I are now waiting for the next harvest to turn into zucchini ribbons. Currently, our favorite recipe is zucchini ribbons shrimp scampi. We can't wait to spiralize butternut squash once it's ready." Deb, thanks for that email. What do you think about, gadgets like that? Do those sorts of tricks make vegetables easier to eat? You're nodding.
Yes, absolutely. So the spiralizer is something that sort of really started taking off about 2 years ago. And now so many people have it and are absolutely nutty for it. And, this listener is right in that zucchini is sort of the gateway spiralizer vegetable, the one that everyone starts with. But the beauty of the spiralizer is that you can really spiralize all sorts of different vegetables. So in this book, we have a turnip spiralized recipe. So it's spiralized noodles made out of turnips, which have like a little bit of a peppery edge to them. And then it's cooked in a broth and it's turned into a pork and turnip noodle miso ramen. It's amazing. It's totally like, wow, I can't even believe this. And then I just made the other day another recipe from this book with a spiralizer. And it's shoestring jicama. So you take jicama and you actually spiralize it. If you don't know what jicama is, it is one of these underdog vegetables that I think.
You might pronounce it jicama. Isn't that how people mispronounce it all the time?
Yeah, well, it's spelled J-I-C-A-M-A. It's pronounced jicama or jicama. I think actually technically the correct pronunciation is jicama. I just can't get myself to say it right.
Oh, this is so good. I love it.
It's delicious. But this is interesting because so you spiralize the jicama, you spiralize a red onion, which actually turns out totally gorgeous noodles. And then you coat them in a little bit of breadcrumbs. I think it has Parmesan in it, and you bake them. And oh my gosh. So you're having these crazy little shoestring jicama onion shoestring things, but they're totally healthy and delicious. They taste indulgent though.
I love that this book is alphabetical by vegetables. So mm-hmm. it's not just a beautiful book, but it's really a handy go-to guide I found. And I see this becoming something that I use in my kitchen all the time. You've got everything from beets and bok choy to fennel, kohlrabi, okra, rutabagas.
Yep.
And even that strange-looking tuber, the Jerusalem artichoke, which for those unfamiliar with it, it looks kind of like a sad potato. And I just want to start because I think this book is really helpful in that it makes some of these lesser-known vegetables – you've got a lot of tips and, you know, here's how you buy them. Here's how you prepare them. Here's some recipes. So let's start with the Jerusalem artichoke because it's not an artichoke. And from what I read in your book, it has nothing to do with Jerusalem.
No. The reason – I don't know where the Jerusalem comes from, but the artichoke part is it actually has a taste like artichoke. It's a tuber. So it almost looks like a knobby potato. And you can slice it and eat the raw slices, but you can also sort of treat it like a potato, you know, cut it up, roast it. We have a real simple take with it where it's roasted in chunks with prosciutto and walnuts. That's just one of the cooking basics in the recipe. It'd probably take you about 5 or 10 minutes to throw this recipe together, and it's just so delicious. Even though you treat it like a potato, it has the taste of an artichoke and then this kind of snappy texture to it that's totally delicious. Huh. But when it's roasted, it gets a little soft and creamy on the inside.
Sounds fabulous.
It's really special.
Listeners, we're talking about Eating Well Magazine's new book, Vegetables, The Essential Reference. Jessie Price is my guest. She's editor-in-chief of Eating Well. If you want to weigh in and join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-639-2211. It's 1-800-639-2211. Or if you're on your computer, you can head over to our Facebook page and add a comment there. Brian in Morrisville emailed us, as someone who cans and preserves both personally and commercially, I recommend a valuable resource book, So Easy to Preserve, from the University of Georgia Extension. He says, for $18, it gives comprehensive, safe, and accurate guidance on canning, pickling, fermenting, dehydrating, freezing, and other means of preserving. So not only can you cook up your vegetables if you use your book, Jessie, you can also save some extra vegetables for next winter. So thanks for that email, Brian. I appreciate it. You have so many recipes in this book, Jessie. How did you winnow them down and where did you get them?
Oh, my gosh. Well, winnowing them down is always the hardest part of being a book editor, you know, because it's like all your children and you don't want to get rid of any of them. So these recipes, some of them were developed new for the book where we thought, okay, we really want to cover Jerusalem artichokes and figure out, you know, to help people know how to use them. But hey, we don't have a lot of Jerusalem artichoke recipes already. So we developed new recipes. In some cases. And then in others, they are recipes that have appeared in the magazine in the past. So they were developed either in our test kitchen, which is right in Shelburne. And we have a team of amazing editors and cooks who are working in there every day, developing new recipes, testing recipes, making sure that they really work so that when you make them at home, you have success. So some of them come from that test kitchen team. And then some of them come from outside contributors, whether they are cookbook authors or chefs or other experts who we work with to assign recipes to.
Wow. We've got a call now from Montreal, so let's go to the phone lines and chat with Lynn. Hi, Lynn. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi. So I have this trick to make creams and soup without adding anything to the vegetables. So I only boil the vegetables until, or steam them until they're really, really soft. And then I put them in the blender and you don't put any of the liquid. You only put the vegetable and then you put a bit of salt and pepper and you just add just enough liquid to have the texture, the thickness that you want. And it can taste really creamy as if you had put cream in it.
So you're making a nice creamy soup, but you're avoiding the dairy. And Jesse Price is nodding at that.
Yeah, I love that. I do that at this time of year when I have a ton of zucchini. That is the simplest, best way to do zucchini, in my opinion, is just I don't steam it typically. I usually do it in a little bit of chicken broth. I cook it and then puree it just with a little bit of the chicken broth and maybe an herb like dill in there and salt and pepper. And oh, man, it's so simple. But you're right. It does have a nice creaminess and body to it.
Hey, Lynn, thanks for that call. 1-800-639-2211 is our number at Vermont Edition if you'd like to join our vegetable conversation today. Jesse Price, what other vegetables did you want to make sure and include that you think are not loved enough or really understood enough?
Well, okay, so going back a little bit too to the question of how do you pick which recipes and which to throw out. One of the vegetables that's in here that I have a real strong personal connection to is okra. I absolutely love okra. And there's probably more pages devoted to okra than maybe you would expect in a book like this. And that's part of the fun, too, of being a book editor is you're in charge. You get to pick a little bit. But I love okra. I was born in Texas. And I ate it growing up, even though I actually was raised in the Northeast. But we did have it. And I think especially up here in Vermont, it's totally underappreciated. And a lot of people just think, ugh, that's that slimy thing that's in gumbo. And yes, it is in gumbo. And yes, it can be slimy. The sliminess in okra is from something called mucilage, technically speaking. And when you cook okra for a long time, that mucilage develops more. And actually, it's great in gumbo because it gives body to the gumbo. But in the book, we have this amazing recipe that a Southern chef named Virginia Willis shared with us. And I was speaking with Virginia and she said, hey, you know, we should do a grilled okra. And, you know, I was like, oh, that sounds amazing, Virginia. And then it didn't come about for a while, but eventually she did the recipe for us. And so it's basically whole okra. You just cut off the very top of it. You toss it with sliced hot peppers like jalapenos or whatever you want. You could do a habanero. It might be a little too hot with that, but habaneros have that nice citrusy flavor. Olive oil, salt, and pepper. So you toss all that in a bowl, and then you put it on a hot grill in a grill pan, one of those pans that has the little holes to sort of hold it in there,
sure.
A grill basket.
Yeah.
And you toss it a few times, maybe 10 minutes, high heat, and it comes out and they're a little charred, seared in spots. And the heat from the peppers just sort of infuses all over the okra. And it is totally delicious. And the quick cooking makes it so that not that sliminess doesn't develop.
And it's funny that you mentioned okra because that is one of those vegetables that I don't buy because I have avoided it. So maybe you'll convince me on that. I'll have to give that recipe a try.
Yeah, I recommend it. And there's a couple of growers at the Burlington Farmers Market who are selling okra this year. So I bought some beautiful crimson okra up there last Saturday. So get out there and get your okra.
We're talking with Jesse Price, editor-in-chief of Eating Well magazine, about the magazine's new book, Vegetables, The Essential Reference. Listeners, you can call us at 1-800-639-2211 if you have a question or a comment to share. Let's go back to the phones now. Let's go to Facetown and talk with Kim. Hi, Kim. What's on your mind?
Hi. I have a huge, not a huge garden, but a garden full of a bunch of broccoli rabe that has now bolted a lot of it, and I can't eat it fast enough, and I wanted some ideas about what to do with it other than just sautéing it with garlic and olive oil and red pepper flakes, which is, like, I'm kind of sick of at this point. So if you have ideas, I'd love to hear it, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks for the call, Kim. Well, she's madly paging through her book. Jesse.
Kim, I feel like you are a plant, honestly. I mean, broccoli rabe, if I hadn't said okra, broccoli rabe would have been my other pick for my favorite underappreciated vegetable. And one, again, that I think, you know, we devoted a bunch of pages in this book to, because I absolutely love it. Broccoli rabe is one of those things that is bitter. And I think Americans are wary of the taste bitter, but once you learn how to tame it, you can fall in love with it. And taming it with things like acid, like from vinegar or citrus, and salt or umami flavors are parts of the ways to sort of learn to love it. So in the book, we have a bunch of broccoli rabe recipes. My favorite is an orecchiette with broccoli rabe, and it's a very traditional dish from Puglia in Italy. And it has it's actually not very dissimilar in flavor from what you described, because it does have the garlic and crushed red pepper. It also has anchovies in it, and it has a very generous amount of anchovies, and they're sort of mashed up and sauteed in the olive oil and then the garlic and the crushed red pepper. And then you have blistered cherry tomatoes with that and the sauteed broccoli rabe, and you toss it all with the orecchiette and then top it with Parmesan cheese, and it's like, oh, it's heaven, summer dish.
Is that the photo right there?
Yeah.
I'm looking at this photo, listeners, and it looks quite yummy. Carolyn posted, my 3-year-old daughter loved that pork and turnip ramen that Jesse mentioned. So we will continue our discussion, and we'll take more of your calls talking about bok choy, chicories, rutabagas, and turnips. Coming up, this is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking about the wonderful world of vegetables with Jesse Price, editor of Eating Well magazine. The magazine just published Vegetables, the Essential Reference, which I am looking forward to taking home and putting to use in my own kitchen. So we got a email from, let's see, Carolyn. Oh, she mentioned her 3-year-old daughter. And let's go back to the phone lines. 1-800-639-2211 is our number. Let's talk with John, who's calling from Bridgewater. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Oh, that's funny. Interesting listening to your show, because I grow flowers and vegetables. And I started eating okra because I like the yellow, the beautiful flower that it makes.
They're totally gorgeous.
So that's what drew you to cooking up okra, John? Sounds like we lost John. Let me go to Lori Ann, who posted this. I like to cook celery root with potatoes and mash them together. It adds a really nice, delicate flavor to the mashed potatoes. This year, I'm gardening with straw bales, and although my peppers are not doing great, the tomatoes are thriving and even self-seeded more than 20 additional plants between the bales. She says, I have two questions. It looks like I will have a million tomatoes, and I would love some fresh ideas. And do you know if growing in the straw bales reduces the nutrients that the plant normally would get growing in the soil? Do you have an answer to Lori's question?
Oh, man, I wish I knew the answer to that straw bale question, but I definitely cannot answer that one. When it comes to tomatoes, the book is truly full of amazing tomato recipes, including, you know, a garden tomato sauce, which is something that, you know, you can make a giant batch of and then, you know, save in your freezer for a cold, dark, dark winter day in January when you need a little something fresh tasting. So I think, you know, if you have a ton, that's a great thing to do with them. There's a really great salsa in here, and I love, you know, just going the extra, you know, whatever, putting in the few extra minutes to make homemade salsa. It is so delicious. delicious, and you can have it on hand all week. I also, at this time of year, usually have a blender gazpacho on hand in my refrigerator, and there's one in this book that's really great, and it's, you know, it's traditional. It's got the bell pepper, cucumber, tomato, a tiny bit of garlic, and then, of course, bread. So there's always a debate with gazpacho about does it have bread or not. Well, the traditional thing is, yes, it has bread. There's plenty of versions out there without it. But I think the bread is what gives it that magical kind of velvety, thick consistency that's really special.
And it's so great on those hot summer days to have a nice bowl of gazpacho. Oh,
I love it. The other thing I will mention, too, I know we're talking about the book, but if you are out and about and see our magazine on the newsstand, pick it up. It has a totally beautiful tomato salad on the cover, which is very traditional. It's just Kalamata olives and herbs and tomatoes sliced, and then a little mozzarella. But in the magazine that's on the newsstand right now is a beautiful story on tomatoes and a ton of amazing recipes in this story, including some surprising stuff, very surprising. There's a tomato and peach cobbler in here.
Huh.
And I said, you know, our food editor, Jim Romanoff, assigned the story and the recipes. And he said, all right, we're doing this tomato peach cobbler. And I said, ugh, that sounds disgusting. I'm like, but you're the boss. You're the food editor. Go ahead. So he assigned it and we got it in and the test kitchen cooked it. And it is just unbelievable what a match tomatoes and peaches in a dessert are. It's very surprising and delicious.
There was another interesting recipe or a couple that caught my eye that were sort of unusual. And one, there were two with the corn on the cob chapter. Mm-hmm. One was summer corn and scallop pasta, but the really surprising one to me was sweet corn ice cream.
Oh,
That one really, I thought, wow.
Yeah, that's another one where I thought, so we did this story for a story a bunch of years ago, maybe 4 years ago, and the recipe developer suggested that, and I thought, you know what, that sounds really interesting.
Well, corn is sweet. You know, it's got that sweetness to it.
It is. It's really sweet. And corn with milk. You know, think of a corn chowder.
Cream corn, right.
You know, creamed corn. So we know those things go together. This is so good. It's rich it has eggs in it. It has sweetened condensed milk, and it has buttermilk for a little bit of tang in it. And it is really something magical and totally unexpected. And it's beautiful, too. It's very yellow and vibrant looking.
Listeners, we're talking about vegetables with Jesse Price, editor of Eating Well magazine. 1-800-639-2211 is the number to call if you'd like to join our conversation. Let's go to Underhill now and talk with Sarah. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi. I wanted to respond to the question someone had about straw bale gardening.
Oh, yeah. Great.
I have done that, and it is a great way to garden, especially if you don't have great soil or you need to be out of your soil for whatever reason. You do need to fertilize. I would fertilize. What I did was I fertilized either watering in a granular fertilizer or using a water-soluble fertilizer about every 2 weeks, which I do in my garden anyway. But yes, the straw does not have lots of nutrients for your plants. You need to keep it well-watered. I use soaker hoses and use them copiously. I grew all my squashes for a couple of years and potatoes in straw bales. Huh. Potatoes are great in straw bales because you don't have to dig them and mash the potatoes before you get them out of the ground kind of thing. You just take the straw bales apart. You do have to be careful to keep the soil evenly moist because if potatoes dry out and then get too wet, I found this out the hard way, then you end up with that hollow core blackish rot in the middle, which is a bad thing.
Right.
But it really works well. And then at the end of the year when you take the straw bales apart, you have lots and lots of mulch.
Awesome. Wow. Sarah, thank you for that call. Let's take another call now from Reg, who's calling from Bennington. Hi, go ahead.
I like okra, and I agree with you on that, but my absolute favorite is eggplant.
Oh, great. I'm glad you brought that up.
I'm a fan of purple, and never take the skin off because that's where all the good vitamins and quality is, but I just wanted to see if you had some exciting, new, interesting thing for eggplant. And I'll also mention the reason we got into eggplant years ago, back in the 50s when I was younger, my mother read an article in one of those, I don't know if it was Woman's Day or Family Circle, one of those type of magazines, that suggested that people should at least once a month try a vegetable or food that they have never eaten before. And so my mother went to the store and saw these purple things and said, well, we've never had those. Let's take one home and see what happens. And
Great call.
The beginning of my love affair with eggplant.
Well, let's talk, Jesse Price, about eggplant, because I think some of our producers were talking before the show even started that vegetable can be a little intimidating.
Yeah. Mitch Wortlieb does not like eggplant. He said he can't even look at it, actually. And so I'm so glad you brought it up. The book has a bunch of eggplant recipes in it. And we have some traditional stuff like an eggplant parm. You've got to have that in the book, right? You know, and we have a caponata in here. But we have a couple that are really unusual and really amazing. So the first one, and this one, this may be one of my favorite eating well recipes of all time. It is a stuffed eggplant, and it's stuffed with pork and shrimp and Thai curry. So it's this Thai-inspired filling with lemongrass and green curry and pork and shrimp, and the eggplant also mixed back into it. It has, jalapeno, scallions, cilantro. It's a little bit elaborate to make. It's like a big deal to make. I think, you know, like this is not your quick weeknight dinner thing, but if you want to really impress people, this thing will absolutely knock their socks off. The flavors are just bold and complex and delicious. And the eggplant is, you know, you serve a half eggplant to each person, and it just comes out looking totally cool and impressive.
Well, what about the prep with eggplant, having to salt it and drain it? And sometimes I find like, oh man, do I really have to do that? Do you really need to do that?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is I have read about that subject ad nauseum, believe me, and there is no agreement. And not only have I read about the subject ad nauseum, we have tested it all sorts of ways. And, you know, because Eating Well is a magazine and we work with contributors from all over the world, we get recipes with all different takes on how to prep it. And that's fine. You know what? I think actually, bottom line is what we've found is it really doesn't matter. But sometimes we will go ahead and do the salting or the soaking or whatever. This one that we have from Michael Solomonov, who's a Philadelphia chef who is just amazing. He does Israeli food. So the recipe in the book from him is a marinated eggplant with green chermoula. And the way he starts it is, so he cuts the eggplant. He's using Asian eggplants, so those long, skinny ones. He cuts them into half moons, and then he soaks them in water, okay, for at least an hour, up to 2 hours. It's water and salt together. He soaks it in there, and it's actually quite salty. It's a third of a cup of salt and eight cups of water. Yeah, so it's like a brine. He soaks it in there, and then he takes it out after the 2 hours, drains it, and pats it dry. And then he fries it in a hot cast iron skillet with a little bit of olive oil, and they get all seared and blackened on the outside and then creamy and soft on the inside. They are just amazing. I think that in this case, the brining that he does seems to do something very special for the eggplant because that texture is really magical. And then it's tossed with the green chermoula. So it's a green herb sauce with cilantro, parsley, lemon, garlic, coriander, and cumin.
You know, just that brine brings to mind a couple other cooking techniques that you bring up in this book or that are brought up in this book. A lot about roasting vegetables and braising vegetables. And I roast a lot of vegetables, but I hadn't really thought about braising.
Yeah. So I think roasting is
So if you're sort of a vegetable newbie, or you don't, you know, you're not really sure what to do with vegetables, or you're just popping them out of the freezer and heating them in the microwave, this is what I would say. If you're busy, just simply learn how to roast them. There is almost no vegetable that does not do well roasted. So toss, cut it, dice it, or just chunk it or whatever. Toss it with a little olive oil, salt and pepper. Put it on a baking sheet. The key is, do not crowd the baking sheet, because then you will be steaming, not roasting. Put it in a hot oven. I think 450 is fine. I will sometimes even pump it to 500. Turn it once. Take it out when it's soft and tender, and that's it. It is the easiest way to have success with vegetables.
I want to briefly talk about just the look of this book, the photography. And also, you know, I'm thinking when I'm cooking something, it's great to have it taste good, but to make it look good is a whole nother thing. So can you talk a little bit? Were you at the photo shoots where they were taking photos that are included in this book? And talk about how they do that.
Sure. Yeah. For eating well, the photos are always important. I mean, we all eat with our eyes first. And I think the best part about this book is that it's really a practical reference, but it's also a coffee table book. Every chapter opens with a totally stunning photo, spread photo of the raw vegetable. And those were all taken by Helen Norman, who is a really amazing photographer who we've been working with for a few years. She lives in Maryland, and she lives on the largest organic farm in Maryland. Her brother runs the farm. She lives in the farmhouse next door. And so a lot of these vegetables were grown right there on the farm that Helen lives on. And I think that's a big part of what makes this book look so great.
Well, lots of great recipes and photos in this book. Jesse Price, thank you so much for coming in to talk with us about it today.
Thanks so much, Nina, for having me.
Jesse Price is editor-in-chief of Eating Well magazine. Their new book is called Vegetables, The Essential Reference. Coming up, did you stay up to hear Hillary Clinton's speech last night at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia? VPR reporters Peter Hirschfeld and Emily Alfin Johnson were there, and we'll talk with them about how the Vermont delegation responded and what the week may mean for the upcoming state primary elections right here in Vermont. You're listening to Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck, in for Bob Kinzel. Let's go now to Philadelphia, where the Democratic National Convention has wrapped up. Last night's main event, of course, was the acceptance speech by the nominee herself, Hillary Clinton. VPR's Emily Alfin Johnson and Peter Hirschfeld have spent the week with the Vermont delegates in Philadelphia, and they join us now with their last impressions from the DNC. Welcome.
Hi, Nina.
Good to be with you, Nina.
You've been reporting all week that Vermont's delegation is decisively pro-Bernie, and many of them were unwilling to support Hillary Clinton. Did her speech last night make a difference to the Vermont delegates? Do you think they were swayed?
Yeah, so after Hillary Clinton's speech last night, I checked in with Jo Sable Courtney, a Vermont delegate, strong Sanders supporter, and she said she was certainly not convinced by what Clinton had to say, but she did find it gratifying that a lot of what Clinton touched on in her remarks was based on things that Sanders had said during his campaign. She said it showed through their work that they'd accomplished something and really gotten something really powerful out of the campaign that Sanders had run.
It's worth noting, Nina, that some of the most adamantly anti-Clinton delegates in the Vermont contingent didn't actually stick around to see Clinton speak at the convention on Thursday night. So Emily and mine's perception of how her speech went over is colored by the fact that the people who were likeliest to have found fault with it weren't there to tell us how bad they thought it was. But there are a lot of Vermonters who went from grudging acceptance of her candidacy to a sense of optimism that, maybe there is a little bit of small p progressive in this person. And she really spoke directly to Bernie's supporters last night, called out the super wealthy and corporations, saying she's going to tax them more to pay for subsidized health care, paid family leave, and college tuition. And there are a lot of people who left this convention more ready to consider her candidacy than were coming into it.
How did their opinions square with the mood and emotions in the rest of the arena last night?
So security on the floor last night was very tight, and I ended up watching most of Clinton's remarks from in front of the California delegation. We actually had a great view of the Vermont area. And from where I was, you could see that there were moments, especially early on in her remarks, where the majority of the delegates around Vermont and in the convention hall were standing and cheering, whereas Vermont's delegates had a more tempered response, a lot of seated applause. But over the course of the speech, the engagement increased. A few delegates, Matt Barong and Astrid O'Leary, stood up during calls for improving opportunities for women. And by the end of the evening, a few delegates were waving the provided Hillary signs and on their feet alongside the majority of the crowd at the Wells Fargo Center.
Like Emily says, Vermont definitely wasn't the most visibly enthralled delegation at Clinton's speech. And on the whole, weren't expressing the unabashed joy and support you saw from a lot of other sections in the arena. They also, though, weren't among the pockets of delegates who were demonstrating outward disdain for Hillary Clinton. Some of Clinton's most ardent detractors wore yellow T-shirts printed with "Enough is Enough" as a sign of protest against her candidacy. There were only probably about 150 of them in this 20,000 seat arena, but they definitely made their presence known. They were looking to create a raucous, and at times they succeeded, but none of the Vermonters were participating in that.
Pete, as the Vermont delegates head home, we're 10 days away from our own state primaries. What does this week do for the Vermont Democratic Party's primary candidates?
There's no way you're going to see the same amount of energy poured into non-Sanders campaigns as you've seen poured into the Sanders campaign. But Emily mentioned earlier Jo Sable Courtney, the delegate who said she's convinced that this revolution moves onward in some way, shape, or form. And I think to some extent it will. This intensity that Bernie Sanders has harnessed during the campaign is looking for an outlet now. And Bernie Sanders himself is calling on his supporters to transmit that energy into political races at the state and the local and even the municipal level. Many of the people I've talked to in Philadelphia this week say they're ready to heed that call. And I think that many of them are going to be on the lookout now for candidates who embody Sanders' progressive ideology, who are running for the House, running for the Senate, running for statewide office, or maybe even school board or select board. The passion that would have gone into getting Bernie Sanders elected may well transfer into volunteerism and fundraising for other candidates. The question is, will that effort go into Democratic candidates, or will it go into candidates who are not Democrats and who are in some cases running against Democrats? There are plenty of House and Senate seats where we see progressives challenging Democrats, and this might give them more of a lift in some cases than it will Democrats.
Emily, Tuesday night's roll call vote was memorable for many Bernie Sanders supporters. People will remember that Vermont initially passed in the roll call so that it could go last, and that gave Sanders the chance to throw the weight of the entire convention behind Hillary Clinton's nomination. You were there, Emily. What was that like?
So Tuesday night was an experience. I learned that competition among the press covering the convention is fierce. It's a contact sport, sometimes even a combat sport. I was a few rows below the delegation, squished between a couple of national news outlets as we all squeezed in to be close to the Vermonters. And among the Vermont delegation, there was an incredible energy, amplified tenfold when Senator Sanders came and sat down with the delegation. And actually, a great moment that people might have missed if you were watching or listening from home, there's an old-fashioned telephone the convention uses to let delegates know that they're coming up next in the roll call. But it was clear that a lot of the delegates didn't realize the phone was there because moments before it was their turn, they were very surprised to hear this phone ringing. One of the lasting memories I will have of this week is the look of shock and surprise on all of their faces when this phone started ringing in their midst.
What lasting impressions will stay with you both from the week in Philly?
So mine would probably be that Vermont, Maine, and New Hampshire's delegations all banded together to form a Northern New England posse down here in Philly. They shared breakfasts, speakers, and a shuttle to the convention events. But there was also a lot of shade thrown at these breakfasts between New Hampshireites and Vermont speakers. And it was loving shade, a lot of history jokes, who owned Vermont when, and it was a lot of state pride too, which was actually a really fun way to rally the troops each day, especially on those days when everybody was emotionally beat or already running on high.
I was struck by the extent to which everything that happened at this convention was done with an eye toward how the scenes in Philadelphia were going to be perceived by the people consuming the media that were covering it. At the convention, for example, the DNC had these eyes in the sky scanning for any sign of protest. And when they would ferret out groups of people that were holding up anti-Clinton banners or demonstrating anything other than the DNC party line, they'd dispatch these dutiful staffers to hand signs to delegates near those areas, instruct them to hold them up to obstruct camera views of the delegates who were attempting to make a statement so that it would make it as difficult as possible for people back home to see that there was anything other than pure and joyful unity going on in this event. And it was the same with the protests outside the convention. It's a production, and it's put on in a very intentional way. And that doesn't mean there isn't an intense conviction of belief at the heart of all that's going on here. But the week felt like an elaborate theater in a lot of ways, designed to tell a compelling story to the people who were watching it in their living rooms at home.
VPR's Emily Alfin Johnson and Peter Hirschfeld reporting from Philadelphia, where the DNC ended last night. Hey, thanks so much, guys.
Thanks so much, Nina. We're excited to come home.
Thanks, Nina.
Our campaign coverage is supported by the VPR Journalism Fund. And finally today, we hear from the latest local music act featured on VPR's Live from the Fort series. Abby Morin describes her band's sound as foxy folk, inspirited and cathartic. She played at venues around Burlington in 2015 after the release of her first album, Shadowproof. Then she hit the road for a tour that included 34 shows in 19 states. She's currently working on her second album. Abby Morin performed a set recently for VPR's Live from the Fort. Here's her song, Cadmium.
In these bones, and I'm telling us, so no one knows about the rubble pile inside me. Troubled stand to try to float, heavy growing pain, chucking me beneath my clothes for the tide that rolls around. Starving for your moonlight, yellow I search so hard, and another's eyes they pale in the night. Love you, let me fall astray. You've been seen, ain't no friend. So met somebody in the old north. start to choke on the cracks and all the ways they've grown. Shadow canyons cut the line. Now pour it out on the page, never sent. Now it's keeping me awake in bed, lonely, burning sage in hindsight.
That's the song Cadmium by Abby Morin, performed for VPR's Live from the Fort. We heard Abby and Thomas Perro on electric guitar, Mitch Manichek on bass, Andy Karikas on drums, Shea Gestel on violin, and Taylor Smith on alto saxophone. And you can check out the entire set at vpr.net. We want to let you know that next week is debate week on Vermont Edition. If you've only been paying occasional attention to the primary races in both parties, this is your chance to hear the candidates make their case for your vote. On Monday, the three Democrats who are running for lieutenant governor will be here, Kay Sharam, Shap Smith, and David Zuckerman. Later in the week, we'll have debates with the Republicans and Democrats running for governor and the Democrats running for the treasurer. You can find details at vpr.net. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone, with production assistance from Jake Burstein. Mary Williams directed the program, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Nina Keck. Thanks for listening.